Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Tamara. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And this song, Roar, is one of a long line of hits created by a hugely successful group of writers and producers working with the top singers, in this case, Katy Perry. All that talent came together to produce a song that everyone liked. Well, almost everyone. John Seabrook, who writes for The New Yorker, was one of the first to hear it when the producer and songwriter known as Dr. Luke played it for him, and Seabrook was unimpressed. Of course, it went on to become a smash hit, and Seabrook has become a fan, however reluctantly. That is just one of the smaller stories he tells in his new book, The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. John Seabrook, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. Nice to be here.
You're giggling when I said that that you were unimpressed. By the end of the book, you're playing those chords on your guitar.
That's
for your
right.
daughter.
But the thing that I left thinking was I right the first time, or was it 10 times of repetition tricked my brain into liking it? And that is the big question with
right.
these songs.
That is a question I want to get to. But instead of starting with a small story, let's talk about the big story,
okay.
which is the idea that music, rather than coming in a burst of inspiration to the creative artist alone in his or her garret, is manufactured in what is essentially a factory of songs.
Yes.
Is that, in fact, a new idea?
It's not new to manufacture songs in the sense of a group of writers write songs for other artists. Obviously, most of popular song, that has been the case. The singer-songwriter era is more the exception, I think, than the rule. But what has changed is that the whole process has become industrialized. So instead of having a melody and a lyric writer sitting around a piano banging out tunes, you have a sizable committee of writers, some of whom are track makers, some of them are beat makers, some of them are hook makers, some of them are bridge makers, and they all write songs. And if you look at the credits in Billboard, you'll see the era of the single songwriter or even of the pair has basically disappeared. Songs are now written by large numbers of people.
And if the song includes a sample of someone's earlier effort,
right.
I mean, I've seen like up to a dozen names on a single track terms of writer credits.
Which is good in that they're actually recognizing the samples now.
So the idea of song factories, I mean, this goes back to Tin Pan Alley.
Sure.
It's not a new idea.
No.
The technology has changed, and with it, the way the songs are put together, you use the expression track and hook.
Yes. So
explain that.
So the way songs are written these days is not a melody writer and a lyric writer sitting around a piano, and then the song gets produced and arranged later. Rather, the song is basically produced first. So it's a producer sitting at a computer, comes up with the beats, the chord progression, and the basic instrumentation. A lot of it is sort of almost automated by various software programs. And you can make a lot of those tracks at the same time. And then the tracks go out to what are called top liners or hook line writers. And those people listen to the track and try to come up with a hook. The producer can send the same track out to multiple top liners and get, you know, multiple hooks based on the same track, which sometimes leads to problems. The song Halo by Beyoncé and Already Gone by Kelly Clarkson were actually written from the same track by accident. Then the words come at the end of the process. So it goes from production to melody or melodies, because it's really, no one talks about melody anymore. It's all melodies. And then finally the words.
It almost sounds like the way, you know, in a restaurant, the way the staff is deployed. You know, you have your chef who does pastries only, right. and you have the right. chef who does the meats only. And there is a kind of similarity in the way they're trying to hit the pleasure centers of the brain, right?
Yeah, I've also been thinking of them as high fructose songs. Because the pleasure center of the brain has to be hit every... Well, in the book, somebody says every 7 seconds you need a hook mm-hmm. to keep people listening to the song on the radio.
Of course, we think locally, and we're talking about American pop music, but this is a global tale.
Yes.
It takes you to Norway, to Korea, but it starts in Sweden.
It starts in Sweden on the day that a producer named Dennis Pop stuck a demo of a song that was then called Mr. Ace by an unknown group called Ace of Base into the tape deck of his car, listened to it once on his way home, decided he didn't want anything to do with the song, but then when he went to eject it, he discovered that it was stuck in his tape deck and his radio was broken, so he couldn't listen to anything else. Ended up listening to the song for a week and then suddenly had this kind of revelation that he knew what to do with it. And that song became All That She Wants. Followed by The Sign, and that put Dennis Pop on the map, and that opened the door for Max Martin, who was Dennis Pop's protege. And the way Max Martin came to fame was through the Backstreet Boys. That was the first American act that Dennis Pop got based on his success with Ace of Base. And that's how it started. But it's gone, you know, following Max Martin.
Right.
Starting with Britney Spears all the way through I Can't Feel My Face, 21 number one hits, the third all-time list behind Lennon and McCartney. Totally incredible.
For Max Martin.
For Max Martin.
Born, what's his birth name?
Carl Martin Sandberg.
Yeah. In Sweden, the country of ABBA, so a country that has a tradition
yes.
of great pop music that
yep.
has broken into the global
studio
market.
Studio made.
Yep.
And the other thing, John, I think I always, I've come back to is good at English, but not that good at English. And not being that good at English means that you don't get caught up in a lot of fancy double entendres and metaphors. And sometimes you even get it slightly wrong, like in the song Hit Me Baby One More Time. I mean, it sounds, if you're an American, it sounds a little bit like an ode to domestic violence.
Right.
But it's really just the Swedes using the latest lingo for Call Me Up, but not getting it quite right. And it hits the ear the right way.
We're talking about hit factories. I'm using the plural, even though your book title is The Song Machine Inside the Hit Factory, because there have been hit
yes.
factories. You know, Music Row in Nashville, Motown. Of course.
The biggest, yeah.
And at one point in the book, I can't remember if it's you saying this or you quoting someone else saying this, the lifespan of these hit factories
right.
is about 6 years.
I just put them all together and looked at them, and it really almost always was 6 years. And then various things would happen. Often the artists who were sort of the ones taking orders from the producers and songwriters at the beginning decided that they didn't want to take orders anymore and wanted more creative input. A lot of times their sound is copied by somebody else. And a lot of times, and up until now, people have tended to turn against so-called manufactured music at regular intervals for sort of so-called more kind of authentic mm-hmm. music. And that often spells the end of that particular hit factory. But in our day and age, that doesn't seem to have happened.
Well, that was my follow-up question.
Right.
What is this Max Martin thing with this unbroken for many, many times, 6 years at this point? I mean, he started in the 90s.
He started in 1998, so he's been doing it for 17 years of number ones now. It's totally unprecedented. One reason, I think, is that he has switched partners from time to time throughout his career. Unlike most songwriting pairs who sort of stay together for as long as the hits last, and then when they break up, that's the end. He has gone from the Swedish 90s Backstreet Boys. Tell me why I'm the Kelly Clarkson, Dr. Luke kind of indie rock sound. And now he's on Taylor Swift and a whole new adventure in making pop songs, bigger than ever, really. And so unlike the others, he's continually switched it up. And I think that's one reason why.
There are a couple of interesting case studies. One of them is Taylor Swift. How has she maintained this kind of aura of authenticity? You know, these are my songs and I'm...
Right.
You know, the creative force driving my career.
Right.
When, in fact, she is part of this machine.
It's a great question. And, you know, she made some kind of deal with her own creativity and with the songwriting gods or devils, whoever they are, and decided that she wanted to go from being a very successful singer-songwriter with a kind of a Nashville kind of natural wood sound to being a global pop icon. And for that, she needed this guy, Max Martin. And in fact, he has written her last 8 hits. And it's amazing that you can have an artist that really has, it's almost like old Taylor and new Taylor. Many things have changed. And yet her persona and yeah, her authority has remained largely intact. And I think partly she does do the lyrics and she's, I'm sure, all over the lyrics. And the fact, I think in a song like Blank Space or Shake It Off, where she kind of writes about herself, mm-hmm. you know, we all know about her romantic troubles, and to kind of keep that going in the song gives a sense of continuity, I guess,
yeah.
from the old days. But sound-wise, certainly, Blank Space is a real departure.
Next mistake, love's a game, wanna play. New money, suit and tie, I can read you like a magazine. Ain't it funny, rumors fly, and I know you heard about me. So hey, let's be friends, I'm dying to see how this one ends. Grab your passport and my hand, I can make the bad guys good for a weekend. So it's gonna be forever, or it's gonna go down in flames. You can tell me when it's over, if the high was worth the pain. Got a long list of ex-lovers, they'll tell you I'm insane.
One thing that Dennis Pop always talked about was letting songs breathe, giving songs space and a sense of air. And I think that Max Martin probably learned that well, and I think Blank Space really does have that sort of sense of air in it.
So Dennis Pop, Max Martin, two of the Swedes who have kind of taken over the pop music world. And Max lives in L.A. now, right, for at least part of the year?
Most of the Swedes have moved to L.A. The whole sort of factory-making process have shifted out of Stockholm to L.A., really just because the artists have to be served. The big difference between the old days of, you know, the Brill Building and these days in terms of the factory process is that the artists are much more powerful. You know, they're global brands, icons, multinational companies, really.
Right.
And the hits are being written for them so that they can sell tickets on their tours because they're not really making the money selling the records.
Mm-hmm.
But no one buys the tickets unless they're hits. And so that's Max Martin lives in Frank Sinatra's old house, which is kind of appropriate because he didn't write his songs either.
Right, right? Of course. The other kind of funny character in this is Eminem.
Yeah.
The artist on the edge,
right,
who is also in the mainstream.
Right.
So that's another kind of tricky balancing act that this artist has been able to pull off. Is he the exception that somehow proves the rule?
Eminem is I guess, a connection to the old idea of authenticity and the artist performing his work. I mean, and that's what hip-hop has done, sort of carried that burden. I mean, it was interesting, the whole flap that arose over Ghost Rider writing one of Drake's raps on his rival Meek Mill's
right.
Track, and that this was such a scandal that a ghostwriter would write a rapper's track, whereas in the pop world, that's the norm, you know.
The very first rap single, Rapper's Delight, had a ghost-written verse in
it. Oh, it did it really?
Yeah.
Did it really?
Yeah, Grandmaster Caz.
Oh, of course, right. Well, you know, I mean, I think, as I said, I think hip-hop has been made to sort of shoulder the burden of the sort of singer-songwriter tradition, really. And it's interesting to see now how hip-hop and pop are sort of dancing around each other and really, I think, merging pretty quickly. And you have artists like A$AP Rocky teaming up with Selena Gomez. And what they make together is actually pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And you have Eminem teaming up with Rihanna.
I wanted the fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music. Wanted to be left alone in public, excuse me. But wanting my cake and eat it too. And wanting it both ways. Fame made me a balloon, cause my ego inflated when I flew see. But it was confusing, cause all I wanted to do is be the Bruce Lee of Bruce Lee.
A song like Monster is a monster hit.
Yeah.
At a time when conventional wisdom would suggest that a fragmenting marketplace means there will be no more monster hits.
Right.
That has not proven to be the case.
Quite the opposite, in fact. In the book, I talk about the long tail and how it was 10 years ago this year, the long tail predicted that streaming services would be the end of, or would curtail the impact of hits, because people wouldn't have to just listen to Katy Perry. They could go down and listen to Joni Mitchell if they wanted to. But it's turned out to be quite the opposite, that people seem to want to listen to these hit songs more than ever. And I think social media must have a lot to do with it. I think that tends to just sort of bind that need to listen to what other people are listening to and magnify it. And I think that music still provides this kind of sense of belonging to one culture in a way that maybe film and books and other forms of popular art don't. You can hear a song being played in a car passing you on the street, and you know the song, and it creates a sort of cultural glue that kind of keeps us at least sort of feeling connected to each other.
The dark side of the coin, of course, is that, as you point out in the book, you have things like 90% of the industry revenue going to the top 10%, you know, those hit makers. Spotify, for all that they like to ballyhoo how they, you know, pay all these artists, most of that revenue is going to the very, very fraction of a percentage who are doing most of the streaming.
I mean, the way it works is Spotify pays out lump sums to the label groups based on all of their artist streams, and then it's up to the label to apportion that money out to their, you know, artists accordingly. And of course the labels are going to give most of the money to the big acts because they want to keep them and re-sign them. And so that also tends to snowball and feed the head and not the tail, I think.
And so we are back to the bad old days when artists signed contracts with record labels that did not pay them a working wage once you figured out, you know, where all this great advance money was going and, you know.
And, you know, what's even, I think, more dire, John, is because, you know, the artists will probably survive, but the songwriters are making far less on streaming than they did on radio. And, you know, because also songs are now written by small committees, you have to split the royalties,
right,
you know, more ways. And it's, you know, it's an open question as to whether the songwriters will be able to make a living. And if they can't make a living, then there's not going to be the songs, which are at the basis of the whole machine. And so it all come kind of crashing down to the ground.
Do you believe that? Do you believe there could possibly be a world in which there's no pop music?
No. No, actually, I don't. I don't. It's as natural to us, I think, as babies babbling, you know.
Yeah.
People kind of relate to it in this sort of tribal way. This is another thing about pop music, I think. It's kind of it. And this is maybe why the Swedes are good at it, is because it binds the group, I think. It's groups, it's songs for group singing. And the Swedes do a lot of group singing, you know, in civic and religious and social situations. They sing a lot, actually, when they get together. And I feel like that is part of what these songs serve. They're like our sing-alongs.
Yeah.
Like Roar, you know, it's a sing-along song.
It's also a song that grew on you with repetition. We started out by you saying that.
Yeah.
And repetition is, I mean, not just the repetition of the same chord progressions in pop music, which has been a hallmark of pop music for as long as we've had it.
Yes.
But the repetition of you hearing, of being
yes.
exposed to it, it kind of drills in there.
It is not an accident that this whole thing started when a guy got a tape stuck in his tape deck and had to listen to it for a week straight. And this was certainly my experience with Roar, which Dr. Luke played for me in his studio before anyone had heard it and said, this is the first single. And while I was listening to it, I was trying to come up with sort of a nice way of, or just a lie, to say that I liked it. And so I did begin to wonder whether these songs are designed in such a way that, yes, you might not like them the first time you hear them, the second time you hear them, but because of the way they're designed and because of the way the hook is implemented in the song, the brain starts to recognize the pattern on second or third listening, and then when it hears it, it begins to kind of finish it in your head just before your ear hears it, and the brain really likes that, you know, just likes it.
So even if you don't like the song, is resistance futile? I mean, is your brain just going to succumb because this is how it works?
I actually do think it. I think resistance is kind of futile. I came to think, and I also think that by being made electronically, being made without instruments, gives the songs this huge advantage. You can come up with a sound that the brain has never ever heard before. A lot of it, I think, is the brain just doing what it does involuntarily, you know, and we have only limited control.
and you know, the one thing about this story that I take away is very late in the book, you talk to a couple of neuroscientists.
Right.
But for the rest of the book, these people are just doing it by intuition.
Yeah.
They're going on bat radar, you know, and they're somehow coming to the same realization without all the science that this is how you get them. This is how you keep them.
And that's still, after all the work I did and the research I did, there's a mystery at the heart of it. Despite all this sort of democratizing technology, still at the very top, there's only a handful and really, you know, six or eight people that do this again and again. And one of them is Max Martin. Another one is this group called, duo called Stargate, who
from
are
Norway.
Norwegians. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of Americans. Jeff Basker is a brilliant one. Ryan Tedder is a brilliant one. But there's very, very few.
So the technology has changed, but to quote Led Zeppelin, the song remains the same.
And I do quote Led Zeppelin in the book.
The book is called The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory by John Seabrook. John, great job. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Really fun.
If you like Soundcheck, consider subscribing to our podcast. It's easy. Just find us in the iTunes store and click on subscribe. We'll send you our latest interviews, in-studio performances, and more. Thanks for listening. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.